But it's also sometimes really hard to look good in the eyes of the world. enter her.
To enter Dina as a
So first of all, we know that it's a great thing that she's able to do it. Mm-hmm. Second thing, we know that returning someone from evil to good is so good, it's worthwhile risking. So she's like, big question. It's not that you do it. Two people in the desert, one has a bottle of water, he has to push drink it. And there's only enough for one person to survive, he has to look after himself. So it's not really true to risk her like that.
So that she could bring him up.
Yeah, it doesn't sound... I mean, obviously, this is a great woman. It's not... You don't say it's, like, any one
person. Yeah, yeah. We're talking about a city
cow. You want to... Okay.
So, also...
He was punished because holding him back. It's not a doubt, but it's clear that she would bring him back into
that. Because like, the fact that Yaakov wants kind of shows that it was very clear. Because otherwise,
he would have been But Shema is like, question. Perhaps she'll bring him back to the kid.
Again, I assume I did tell you I wasn't going to be here last week because I was I had a very brief trip into the United States and back, and for some reason I am suffering progressive jet lag. I felt fine when I came back, and it's getting worse. I'm not sure why that's happening. Maybe I'm getting younger or something. But anyway, one of the places I spoke was in a synagogue that's called the Old Harlem Synagogue. So there actually is a shul in Harlem, which is really near Columbia University, so it's good to know that you know, there's a Jewish life there as well. Anyway, we were still in the middle of a topic. Remember, we're doing this is probably our last class on it. We are doing issues of reproduction and the like, and I want to go back a little bit because there was a very, very important source that I neglected to mention that you need to be aware of. When we were discussing egg donation and gestational surrogacy, right? Those are just the opposites. Egg donation is when husband and wife get an egg from a donor and the wife carries the baby. That's called egg donation. And gestational surrogacy would be where husband's sperm fertilizes wife's egg in vitro, and then because, let's say, there's a hysterectomy or something like that, so the baby will be carried by a third party. But the common denominator, although they're opposites, but they raise the identical question, and that is the issue of maternal identity. Maternal identity is extremely important because that determines whether the child is Jewish or not. And normally it's fairly easy to know who the mother is, but in egg donation or surrogacy cases, you actually have two different people that could claim to be the mother. There is the egg donor, which is the genetic mother, the one whose genetic contribution is 50% of the chromosomal materials. And then you have the gestational, the woman that carried the baby, who also contributes, without getting too technical, mitochondrial DNA. Again, we don't have to get into all the biology of it. But a woman who carries a baby is more than just a pure mechanical incubator. There is, even to the non-genetic contributor, there is actually a certain amount of certain kind of DNA that is contributed, that is necessary for life.
So the mitochondrial ends up being from the
gestational.
Oh,
that's correct.
It's not carried in the egg.
No, no, wow. It is hormonally created, and that's necessary for life.
Right.
So be it as it may, therefore, this is a very practical question. It's a practical question. If I am, you know, if a husband and wife, you know, religious couple, use a donated egg, and in the United States you will always assume, unless you know to the contrary, that the donated egg is from a non-Jewish woman, because you remember the fundamental rule that all doubts as to origin are always allocated to the majority element of a population, right? You know that principle. This is called following Rove. Rove is the Hebrew word. Following the majority, Israel would be different. So the question is, if genetics determines maternity, the child would need conversion. Although he was physically born from a Jewish mother, the child would need conversion, and we would treat him like an adopted child. And he wouldn't be a Kohen if the father's a Kohen or anything else. He would be a convert, as a matter of fact. If, on the other hand, I look at gestation, giving birth, as the determinant, the child would be born Jewish, would not need conversion, and if the father was a Kohen, the child would be a Kohen. Now, gestational surrogacy is exactly the opposite. If I look at genetics, if the egg is from the Jewish woman, the child would be Jewish. If I look at birth, the child would be non-Jewish. You know, you understand that it's the same question, except it just gets flipped around. So the short answer is that all of these are uncertain. A majority of opinions seem to say that gestation is the most important, interestingly enough, which would mean that in the case of the donated egg, born from a Jewish mother, the child is Jewish. In the case of gestational surrogacy of a non-Jewish woman, the child is not Jewish. But there's a minority view that goes the other way. So basically, it's a very, very controversial and not completely resolved area of halacha. Once you move into these areas, things are very tricky. But I want to share with you one medrash that is often used to give some indication of this problem. Now, let me just digress for a moment, and that is, midrashim technically are normally not used as halachic sources. You know, we know in the oral law, in the Gemara, the Medrash, whatever it is, we have parts of the Talmud, around 65%, which is halachic discussion. It discusses the laws of Judaism. And then we have large parts of the Talmud that are called Agada. So it depends. Sometimes we call it Agada with an Aleph, and sometimes we use the Hebrew Hagada. Right? So Aramaic is like Cockney. You don't pronounce the H. Mm-hmm. And the like. So Agada and Hagada, which is the same word for the Agada of Passover, Pesach, is the same word. And Agada, actually, it's hard to define what Agada is. Really, the only definition of Agada is everything in the Talmud that's not halakha. It's Agada. Because Agada is a huge thing. It's the biblical stories. It's teachings of ethics and morality. It's even the Chachamim's reflection on science and philosophy and medicine and the like. And the idea of Medrash, the Medrash is simply, you know, it's not in the Talmud. It's a non-Talmudic compilation of Agada. Okay, so Agada is a general term that includes Haggadic passages in the Gemara and Haggadic passages in the work that is called Medrash. Now, although it is absolutely the case that Haggada and Midrashim contain very, very profound understandings of God and our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they are really the basis of even Kabbalah. The basis of Kabbalah is rooted in these different midrashim. It is also the case that because they have symbolic and esoteric meanings, they are normally not used for concrete halacha. In other words, you can't prove a halachic point from a medrash or an agada. So there is this concept of double, double vision, meaning halachic matters are proven from halachic texts, and although agada is a source of values and philosophy and mussar and the like, we don't use it for actual halachic ruling. So what I'm telling you is not to be taken as a halachic ruling, but it's fascinating that there is a medrash that gives us some resolution to this question. And the medrash is the following. This medrash will be, you're going to read it in the Chumash in 2 weeks. No, actually, no, this coming Shabbos. This coming Shabbos, actually. In this coming Shabbos, right, we read... But this parsha, by the way, is one of the most packed parshias, because it actually includes all of the years that Yaakov spends in Laban's house, and the birth of all of the tribes. Right, they all get born, right, in this coming parsha. And you will recall that Leah basically had 6 sons, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zevulun, and then each of the maidservants had 2 sons, right, Dan, Naphtali, and then Gad and Asher. And then Rachel had 1 son, Yosef. After Rachel had 1 son, so now you have 11 tribes. After Rachel gave birth to Yosef, Leah became pregnant. Before Rachel became pregnant with Yosef, it was before, after Leah had 6, and the tribes had 2, and the maidservants had 2 and 2, so that gives you 10. There was a pregnancy that Leah had. Leah got pregnant, and Rachel got pregnant. It is brought down in the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel, which is a medrash. I'll actually explain what type of medrash that is. That originally, when Rachel was pregnant, she was pregnant with a girl. And when Leah was pregnant, she was pregnant with a boy. Leah prayed that God should switch the embryos, and God should miraculously take the boy out of Leah's womb and put it into Rachel's womb, and take the girl out of Rachel's womb and put it into Leah's womb. And that boy became Yosef, and that girl became Dinah. Now, why did Leah pray for the embryo switching? Because she knew with Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, that there would only be 12 tribes. Now, there's already 10 of them. If she has a boy, if she would have had Yosef, that would have made 11. That would have only left 1 tribe for Rachel. It would have made her inferior to even the maidservants. So in order that Rachel should not be inferior to the maidservants and should have at least 2 tribes, Leah prayed to Hashem that he should switch the embryos so that the girl that was in Rachel's body would go to Leah's body, and the boy that was in Leah's body should go to Rachel's body, an embryo switch. Now, that actually means that Yosef was genetically Leah's child. In other words, the genetic chromosomal material came from the fertilization of Leah's egg. And Dinah, right, genetically, was a child of Rachel. However, Dinah's birth mother was Leah, and Yosef's birth mother was Rachel. Now, since the Torah consistently says over and over again that Dinah is the daughter of Leah, and Yosef is the son of Rachel, even though genetically it was the opposite, so what do we see from that midrash? We see from that midrash that maternity is based on birth and not on genetic contribution. Now, as I say, we don't prove halacha from this, but it's fascinating that this issue of split motherhood is exactly what the Targum Yonasan says happens miraculously, supernaturally, of course, in the case of Rachel and Leah. Now, it's interesting that this concept of embryo switching is this medrash's unique twist. Rashi just says, see, Rashi also brings a very similar idea. Rashi says, Leah prayed that the male in her womb should be turned into a female. But that doesn't make it an embryo switching. As far as we know, she still would have been from Leah's genetic contribution. The Kiddush, so according to Rashi, you'd have no proof on this question. But Yonasan ben Uziel makes it differently. He says, Nischalfu ubrehon. That's Aramaic for the fetuses or the embryos were switched. Right, so it's fascinating that Chazal somehow understood that whole story to be a case of gestational surrogacy, and who would be given, who would be the mother, and the like. I'll come back to that. Now, let me just for your own general edification, having nothing to do with the topic, I just want to explain. I mentioned Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. I just want to tell you what that is. All of you should be familiar. Every standard Chumash has, in addition to the Chumash text, has something called Targum Unkelus. How about you? Does that Chumash have Targum Unkelus? Maybe not.
No.
A lot of Chumashim with translations don't have it because... Yes. Yeah. Right. What is that column there? No, that's the Chumash. Right. What is that? That's called Targum Unkelus. Now, Targum means the translation of Unkelus. Unkelus was the name of a person. Unkelus, in fact, was a nephew of a Roman emperor who converted to Judaism at great risk to his life. And he translated the Torah into Aramaic. Now, that doesn't help us very much, perhaps, but you have to know, during the time of the Second Temple, even in the land of Israel, Aramaic was a much more widely spoken language than even Hebrew. So as a result, Unkelus was extremely important in conveying the proper translation of the Chumash. And Rashi, the great commentary Rashi, constantly uses Unkelus to understand the word. In fact, there is a mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah that women have per se, that every man, again, it's not a mitzvah on women, but every male is supposed to read the Parsha of the week every week, by reading every verse twice and the Targum Unkelus once. This is called Shnayim Mikra, reading the verses twice and reading the Targum once. Now, some people say that since today we don't understand Aramaic. I mean, we know the Aramaic from the Hebrew instead of vice versa. So some people say reading an English translation would be just as good. But for hundreds of years, in the Torah reading in Shul, there was actually a meturgeman, a translator, who after the verse would be read, there would be a translation in Aramaic, because that was the spoken language. That is still done among the Yemenites. Here in Jerusalem, if you ever go to a Taimani congregation, you will actually see this. Now, Aramaic is, of course, a very important language for Judaism. Aramaic is the language of the Talmud and the language of the Medrash, but there are very, very few native Aramaic speakers today. In other words, the only people who speak Aramaic are some Christian villages in Syria. They are native Aramaic.
Zoroastrians? Are they still around?
Some are.
Do you speak Aramaic?
No, not necessarily. But the Kurds do in the UN. Yeah. So Kurds and some Christian Arabs in Syria are the native Aramaic speakers and the like. So, for example, I'll take myself for example. Obviously, I can read and translate Aramaic fluently, but I wouldn't be able to have a conversation with Aramaic, right? Because that's not a conversational language. I only know it from Gemara. But there are, names. So this woman in Syria could probably, know Aramaic much better than I know it, and the like. Now, Targum Unkelus is a very literal Targum, meaning it's a literal word-for-word translation. However, at the same time as Targum Unkelus, there were other translations of the Chumash, which were made by very, very great rabbis as well, in which they would embellish and amplify the translations with many, many midrashim. So Unkelus never brings in midrashim. Unkelus just gives you word for word, but there are other targumim that amplify with midrashim, and the most popular of these targumim is a targum written by a rabbi called Yonasan ben Uziel. He's not even called Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, he's called just Yonasan ben Uziel. Now, this is a very interesting person. All of you have heard of Hillel. It mentions Hillel had 80 students. And the greatest of his students, the greatest and the holiest of his students, was Yonasan ben Uzziel. And it mentioned that Yonasan ben Uzziel was so holy, was so kadosh, that when he would learn, all the Malachi Hashareis would come to hear him, and there would be fire above his head, and if a bird would fly over his head, I'm not sure how high, the bird would get burnt with his holiness. And this is the Targum. So actually, he is a great source of Ruach HaKodesh and the like. Now, what's interesting is this. Yonasan ben Uzziel is buried, and perhaps you know this part of the story. Yonasan ben Uzziel is buried near Tzfat in a very, 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 very deep valley called Amuka, which means deep valley.
Oh, this is where people go.
That's correct. That's right. So Amuka is a place where, for various reasons, because he was buried away from people, so he suffers, he understands the pain of isolation. It is a place that people go to pray that Hashem should give them their proper shidduch.
He also wasn't married, wasn't he?
I'm not sure. I have not seen that, but it's possible. I've heard people say that, but I have not seen a mucker for this.
Why did he pray there for a shidduch?
Well, because the concept is that the tzaddik that went through that suffering can empathize, and therefore he will bring your prayers to Hashem. Now, again, like all kivrei tzaddikim, you don't pray to the person; you pray to Hashem. But the tzaddik helps your prayers and going. You know, whatever, every kever, the Rebbe's kever, any kever you go to, you are never supposed to pray to the actual person.
To the tzaddik? You're not supposed to do that.
You can converse to the tzaddik, but you don't pray to him, you know. Now, let me just say that what often happens is that people often lose their sidurim there, if you get my drift, and, you know, they kind of, you know, you be sure you write your name and address in your sitter. You lose it, you just forgot to take it. And some young fellow who wants to sincerely fulfill the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, returning a lost article, will call, and we are told that shidduchim have been made based on that particular expedient. So Hashem has many, many different ways that these brachos do happen and the like. But I hope that if a boy left his sitter there, the other boy would also do it. Now, it shouldn't just be a boy-girl thing. It should be the mitzvah of Hashava Saveda and the like. Now, one thing though, and that is, in spite of everything I told you, the attribution of this Targum that is called Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel is probably incorrect for the following reason. The Gemara in Megillah tells us that Yonasan ben Uzziel wrote a Targum on the Nevi'im, the books of the prophets, and not on the Chumash. And he wanted to write it on the Ksuvim. But the Ksuvim predict when Mashiach comes, and there was a big earthquake. Hashem didn't allow him to write it. So according to Gemara and Megillah, the only Targum that was written by a great rabbi was Targum Ungelus, and therefore many say the attribution of the other Targum to Yonasan ben Uzziel is not true. And even in the academic world, it is called pseudo-Yonasan. And the truth is that is an academic statement that actually fits. Unlike many other academic statements, it actually fits the Gemara that says that Yonasan ben Uzziel did not write a Targum on the Torah. But it's still considered a Medrash, equivalent to a Medrash, and it has a certain authoritative value. So if you open up any Chumash with a lot of commentaries, I don't know if you're looking at those Chumashim yet, so you see Ramban and Rashi and everything, Targum Unkelus, you also see something called Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel, and this is an example of a medrash that is brought in about the embryos being switched. Okay, now, so that's one proof, but as I say, number one, it is not the way Rashi described the process. Rashi did not describe embryo switching. Rashi just described sex change. In other words, Rashi just said she prayed that the boy turn into a girl, but genetically it was still Leah's child. So according to Rashi, you don't have any proof. It is only the Targum Yonasan that talks about embryo switching. And finally, even if you accept the Targum Yonasan, as I indicated, we do not use Midrashim to decide halachic matters, because Midrashim have esoteric meanings and other dimensions that we're not entirely sure what they always mean. Now, let me mention another proof, and I discussed this Gemara, and in fact, one of the students, I don't remember which one, but take credit where it's well deserved, actually pointed out right away that this was a proof to the question, but I want to elaborate because I didn't elaborate at the time, and I'm not sure if everyone got this. We were discussing a few weeks ago the very interesting scenario of a non-Jewish woman who converts while she is pregnant. And the Talmud basically, in other words, basically she got pregnant as a non-Jewish woman. Now, it makes no difference if she got pregnant from a Jewish man or a non-Jewish man. That's not even important. But she got pregnant as a non-Jew. And she converts by going to the mikveh. So the Gemara discusses the question, do the kids have to go to the mikveh when they're born? Or is the immersion of the mother an effective immersion for the babies? Can the babies be covered by the mother's dunking? Yes. Now, why shouldn't they be covered? Because there is a rule by mikveh, right, called chatzitza, right? What is chatzitza? Mm-hmm. Chatzitza means when a woman or a man, for that matter, goes to the mikveh, there can't be anything separating their skin from the water. That's why very simply got to remove all makeup.
But the baby's attached.
Huh?
The fetus is attached.
But the baby is totally covered up by the mother. Right? No part of the baby is.
But the baby and the mother are one. They're attached to each other.
Okay, so the Gemara discusses that, but initially the question is the mother's body an interposition or an interposition between the water and the baby, or is it not? And the Gemara concludes that since the mother is necessary to give the baby life, the baby in pregnancy cannot live without the mother's breathing and everything else. So in a sense, this is the baby's life support. And that which is your life support is not called a chatzitza for tefillah. Now that itself has interesting implications. What if a person needs an oxygen tank or something like that? In other words, it could very well be that anything you need to keep you alive is like part of you. Just we would say the baby is part.
Or an insulin pump.
Yeah. But the issue is this. I mean, the critical issue is not if you need it to be alive generally, but do you need it to be alive at the moment you're going into the water? I mean, the insulin pump.
Can you remove it?
Yeah,
though?
You can.
Yeah, if it's removable. Okay. I mean, if it's not removable, I agree with you.
She does not take off, ever.
Why, is this pump surgically attached?
I think so.
Really? Yeah. I thought you just wear it or something.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, no. People that have heart conditions, and have, like,
okay, a pacemaker. Yeah, well, a pacemaker is internal anyway. Okay, internal things are not a chatzitza anyway. I mean, chatzitza is something outside of me. But the mother is outside of the baby. So the Talmud concludes, though, that since the baby needs the mother to live, it's not an interposition, so the baby is covered by the mother's immersion. Now, let's think about this. By saying the baby is covered by the mother's immersion, that's actually saying that the baby is a goy who needs to be converted. I mean, why don't you look at it another way? If the baby isn't born until the mother is Jewish, the baby doesn't need... I mean, the same way, if the mother got pregnant after her conversion, we would simply say the kid is a born Jew. Then let's say the same thing here. The child was born. In other words, why is the Gemara analyzing it in terms of is the immersion valid for the fetus? That implies the fetus is a non-Jew that needs a conversion process. Now, if you think about this, when a pregnant woman converts, it's just like an egg being donated from a non-Jewish woman, meaning to say the egg donor is non-Jewish, but the birth mother is Jewish, except in this case it's the same woman. In other words, when her egg was fertilized, she was non-Jewish. Then you became Jewish. So the very fact that you need a conversion implies actually the opposite of the Midrash, the opposite of the Midrash, right? That identity is formed by the genetic egg that was fertilized, which then needs a conversion. And therefore, in the case of an egg donation, the child would need a conversion. Now there's a shaila, maybe the Jewish mother could go to the mikveh and that would count, you know, that the same way the non-Jewish woman goes to the mikveh, maybe the Jewish woman can go to the mikveh and that would count, but at least there would have to be an immersion in a mikveh. You see, so this is a subtle raya, a subtle proof, but this is a halachic text, by the way, so this would actually have a little more weight, and this moves in the opposite direction that indicates that Jewish identity is established upon conception, which is why you need a conversion process. Because if Jewish identity is established upon birth, you wouldn't need a conversion process. The child would be a born Jew, right? This is a bit of what we call a lumdish raya, a bit of more of an analytical type of proof. So let me tell you, though, that there was the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, again, these are names that you probably don't hear about at all, but let me tell you a little about him, because there's an interesting connection to Chabad. On one hand, you could say that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the Rav of Brisk. He was, you know, that's the ultimate of Misnagdim, right? The ultimate of Misnagdim, the height of rational, analytical, Talmudic analysis. But you know, when the Rebbe Rashab of Sholem Ber, the Rebbe before the Friedeker Rebbe, established the first Chabad yeshiva in Poland in the 1920s. No, it must have been earlier than that. Before World War I, 1910. So he wanted the most distinguished Rosh Yeshiva in the world to head this yeshiva. And he actually asked Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the premier Talmudic gadol, to be the head of the yeshiva. And Rav Chaim agreed. Rav Chaim was going to become the head of the Chabad yeshiva. The last minute, it fell apart for some political reasons. But Rav Chaim had a very, very close relationship with the Rebbe Rashab. So although on some level, Brisk and Chabad are two opposite worlds, but Rav Chaim happened to be very, very close with the Rashab, and they trusted each other a lot, and they would get advice and counsel from each other on many, many difficult communal issues. Okay, so therefore I'm allowed to tell you something Rav Chaim said. but Rav Chaim was known, and again, without belaboring it too much, the Rashab was mefursam, again, among all the Chabad Rebbes, as extremely deep, his mamorim are really the most complicated. They're the longest and the most complicated. And by the same token, Rav Chaim was known for his extreme depth. So one could imagine two very extremely deep, great gedolim would find a camaraderie, because they were both very, very complex and deep thinkers. So Rav Chaim wants to say the following. Rav Chaim wants to say that there's a difference. He wants to say that the din, that if a pregnant non-Jewish woman converts, the baby has a non-Jewish identity that needs a conversion, is only true if the embryo is more than 40 days old. So if she converts after 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, then the baby needs immersion. But if the woman converts within 40 days of the pregnancy, since before 40 days, the embryo is just a drop of water, the embryo has no halachic existence. So if day 40 comes after the immersion, the child gets a Jewish identity immediately. And therefore, according to Rav Chaim's analysis, it would stand to reason that with egg donation, since the fertilized egg is implanted in the woman's womb less than 40 days, Rav Chaim argues, it would be a Jew by birth, not a Jew by conversion. Because wherever it is when it reaches its 40th day is what it is. If it's in a Jewish body on day 40, it's a Jew. If it's a non-Jewish body on day 40, it's a non-Jew. And that which the Gemara says, that the fetus is a non-Jew that needs a conversion, is only because it was there more than 40 days. That's Rav Chaim, and again, that's a very brilliant insight. And that, again, if you're following me, that would lead to the conclusion, once again, that egg donation would not need conversion, right? So if this confuses you, it is confusing just to go back and forth, but I just wanted to at least complete some of the basic proof texts regarding this particular issue. Yeah.
If the Gemara says that the baby is covered after 40 days by the mother's immersion,
that's what the Gemara says, yep.
It's not practiced that way today, if I'm correct? Like the baby is still immersed after?
No. As a matter of fact, if that happens, the baby would not have to be immersed. That's very, very clear. It's very clear if the mother converted after 40 days,
she immersed
her immersion in the mikvah will be valid to cover the babies. However, for a lot of reasons, if we know the woman is pregnant, we will normally not do a conversion until she gives birth. If we did it, it would cover the fetus, but generally speaking, we do not convert pregnant women. There are reasons, because it's a little uncertain whether the child is because of how to interpret the Gemara, and I didn't give you the whole Gemara. Mm-hmm. It's not clear if the child would be a convert or a natural born Jew, and because of the uncertainty of status, we prefer not to do conversions on a pregnant woman, and even if she doesn't know she's pregnant, we will require a pregnancy test. But if after the fact a pregnant woman was converted after 40 days, the baby would not need re-immersion.
Female converts need to take a pregnancy test?
It depends. If she's a single woman, we may not require it because we'll just assume she's not. Although today those are questionable assumptions. If she's a married woman, yeah, we will require her to take a pregnancy test. Yeah, because there's, as I say, it's a complicated question. There are many uncertainties regarding a child that was conceived to a non-Jewish mother, then became Jewish. Whether it's a converted child or whether it's a natural-born Jew, and therefore to avoid the uncertainty of status. Now, there's a child for sure is Jewish, but is he a ger or is he a?
That would only affect the next generation, right?
Right.
Yes. That's correct. That's only the immediate generation. Yeah.
Because if he's the child of a ger or a ger, he has the same law.
That's correct.
But it's about whether his child could then marry a kohen.
But even a more basic question, he might be a kohen himself. Meaning, if the non-Jewish woman got pregnant from a Jewish man, let's say she was with a Jewish man, if the child is a ger, the child is not a kohen. If the child is a born Jew, the child is a kohen. Actually, you know, so that would be a very important issue. Okay. All right. So that was point number one I wanted to talk about. Now, point number two. Again, this is just going back in different parts. We spent a lot of time on stem cell retrieval. And if you remember the bottom line of our discussion, I said that many, many poskim say that if you have an embryo that was fertilized in vitro fertilization, you are allowed to obtain stem cells for stem cell research, even though you're destroying the embryo. Because although Jewish law, halacha, prohibits abortion unless the mother's life is in danger, but many opinions say that the laws of abortion apply, even if they apply less than 40 days, which the Rebbe said and Reb Moshe Feinstein said, they were strict on that, but it only applies when it's implanted in the uterus, which will bring it to fruition in the normal course of events. And an unimplanted embryo, which is actually called in medical science pre-embryo, is not subject to the abortion laws because it is not in the environment that will bring it to fruition in the course of normal embryonic development. Now, I had mentioned that would also justify, I'm just reviewing some things before I get to the new point, that would justify pre-implantation genetic screening for Tay-Sachs, etc., for other genetic conditions, because although you couldn't abort a baby that's in the womb, but pre-implantation you could, right? So do you remember, I hope you remember that discussion. So now I just wanted to add something, the following. I wanted to add that in all of the cases I gave you about stem cells, the embryos were created for fertility, meaning husband and wife went to a in vitro clinic to have kids, and there are extra embryos, etc. So we talked about pre-implantation genetic screening and the like. But there's also something that science allows that is called a research embryo. Now, a research embryo is the following scenario. Husband and wife, or you know, man and woman, they don't have to be married, they simply agree to donate egg and sperm lechatchila to be used for research. Meaning it's not a spare embryo that was created for fertility that they then decide they can't implant because there are so many. But this was deliberately created for research. Right? The term that bioethicists use for the first case is spare embryos. Spare embryos are those that were created for procreation that are not going to be used. And these are called research embryos. And again, legally it's perfectly allowed. I mean, people can, you know, fertilize, you know, they can sign up for a scientific protocol and they'll donate their embryo to science. The question is, would halacha itself differentiate? In other words, assuming the permissibility of obtaining stem cells from an embryo that originally was generated for procreation, would halacha permit the deliberate creation of an embryo that is destined from its initial creation for research purposes? Is there a difference here? Because once, and after all, you might say, well, once it's not an abortion, then what's the difference?
The intent matters.
So, you know, some bioethicists, including Jewish ones, who are not necessarily religious, but they, you know, there's actually a famous bioethicist who's, I shouldn't say he's not religious, he is a traditional Jew, he's not an Orthodox Jew, but he is a sensitive spiritual. I don't know if you've heard of Leon Kass. K-A-S-S. He's a very prominent bioethicist. He often says that things shouldn't be right because they smell bad. He calls it the smell factor, which is kind of analyzing ethical problems by intuition, which is not always a safe guide. But I would say this. I would say halacha has one very concrete problem with research embryos. And this may come out of left field, but it is a real problem. And that is the prohibition of masturbation. Because here's the thing. When we discussed in vitro fertilization, and we discussed how could in vitro fertilization be permitted, by definition, the sperm is being emitted, let's say from the husband, and not sperm donor. In other words, husband and wife, the sperm is being emitted not through intercourse. So what was the heter? That since it's being obtained for the purpose of trying to have children, it is a procreative emission. And therefore, because it is a procreative emission, it is not called the wasting of semen. So that alone would indicate that the whole justification of any in vitro fertilization procedure can only be an attempt to have children. Because any in vitro procedure that is deliberately done just for the purpose of generating a research embryo would be condemned. Again, it's kind of a left field prohibition. The problem is not the destruction of the embryo. The problem, because that would be permitted since it's unimplanted. The problem would be the emission of the sperm for a non-procreative purpose. That's why I call it left field, because it's not the issue that you would identify as the problem, but it is. There is a very severe aveira on the part of a man to emit sperm levatala. Levatala means for naught. And the whole heter of in vitro, which on its face would involve levatala, is because it's being done for procreation. So a research embryo, by hypothesis, is not done for procreation. So you'd have that very severe aveira. Although I'm going to come back later and actually qualify this with an exception. Okay, so I think we would therefore say that in spite of the leniency regarding the obtaining of stem cells, a Jewish man would not be permitted to donate sperm to to create a research embryo that is going to be destroyed.
But what about general sperm donation to a sperm bank?
Yeah, well, we would say once again, well, that's a very interesting question. So here it's a little tricky. Well, the bottom line is we certainly say that it's usher, absolutely usher. It's considered to be forbidden. It's the sperm is being in vain. Now, keep in mind the following. If the male sperm goes to a non-Jewish woman, the Jewish man is not considered the father. So essentially, his sperm has not generated a child that is halachically his child. And therefore, for sure, it's considered waste.
But a Jewish sperm bank exists.
Well, as far as I know, they don't exist. Although maybe in Israel might be the closest as possible.
Yeah.
Well, once again, you have a point because if the sperm does go to produce children,
and it's intended to.
But on the other hand, if it's a child that you don't intend to, that you or the donor doesn't intend to raise, so that's called a non-procreative purpose, meaning. Procreative purpose means a child that you're going to raise, not a child that you're not even going to know about. Although, it's not so obvious why that should be the case, because Lamaisa, if I produce biological children, I have fulfilled the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply, even if I don't even know who I have. But nevertheless, it seems that the heter, the psak, only applies to the children that you're going to raise.
So, wait, from the logic of what you said, if a Jewish man is married to a non-Jewish woman, those children aren't his children?
That's correct. People don't get this. Everyone knows matrilineal descent, but a lot of people don't understand the implications of matrilineal descent. Matrilineal descent means if the mother is Jewish, the kids are Jewish, right? Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. But there's an implication, and that is they do not have a halachic paternal relationship with their non-Jewish father. And vice
obligated to honor their father?
Well, I'll come back to that. And vice versa. If a Jewish man has children from a non-Jewish wife, whether those kids convert or don't convert, they do not have a halachic paternal relationship to their father. Now, okay, that's the implication of following the mother. Following the mother isn't just a question of following the mother. It actually means that if the mother's Jewish and the father's not, the kids are not related to that man. If the father's Jewish and the mother's not, the kids are not related to the Jew, even if they convert eventually. Now, what are the implications of that? So the implications are not as... Well, the implications are very serious, but they're not quite as bad as you would think. Does the child have to honor his parent? Absolutely yes. But technically, if you want to be pedantic, and I guess in halacha we have to be pedantic, it is not because it is his father. Halachically, it's not his father. Halachically, there is no father. It's amazing, right? Halachically, there is no father. But you must honor the person and love the person who raised you, who took care of you, who gave you a home. And the same way, if you adopt a child, technically you're not the father or the mother.
So is the kid a mamzer?
No. Baruch Hashem, he's not a mamzer. It depends. If the father is not Jewish and the mother is, the kid is a Jew without a halachic father. And if the mother is not Jewish and the father is Jewish, the kid is a non-Jew without a halachic father. He's not a mamzer.
Going back to the eggs.
Yeah.
If an egg's put in a situation where it doesn't develop before 40 days.
Before 40 days, yeah.
Then it's
implanted
into a woman
that's
considered Jewish.
According to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, not everybody agrees, the child will be considered Jewish. Yes. And the egg is always implanted before 40 days. That's always.
And it doesn't matter how long it stays. Because it's not in a growing environment.
That's correct. If the egg is frozen for 5 years, it is arrested at 14 days or whatever it is. Yes, that's Rav Chaim's Chiddush. Rav Chaim's Chiddush is, he brought in the idea of 40 days, which again is, it fits very well, a number of Talmudic concepts. Again, it's an example of Rav Chaim's great depth and brilliance. Okay, so I do want to point out that certainly you owe your non-Jewish father love and care and concern and the like, but technically it's not a father. Now that would mean for inheritance rights, you would not inherit with your other kids from the non. If a non-Jewish man had a non-Jewish wife and had kids, and you were born from the Jewish wife, since you are not considered the legal child, you would not have the right to inherit that property unless there was a will. Right? So there are legal complications here. But one has to know that human relationships, even in halacha, go beyond the strictly legal. We don't deny the reality of love and affection that exists and the like. Okay. Okay, so now let's move into something we began, but now I'm going to elaborate on a little bit more, and that is I want to go back to cloning and revisit some aspects of cloning. Cloning, and again, if you remember the fancy term I gave you, somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT. And let's again describe the simplest. Cloning can come in a lot of varieties too. Let's take the simplest example of cloning. You have, let's say, an egg, and the egg has a nucleus, and the nucleus contains, 50% of chromosomal material that when it's joined with another germ cell like sperm, you get a full complement, and that is why an embryo is normally the fusion of two halves, 50% from the sperm, 50% from the egg, that creates a human being through gestation over 9 months. Now, cloning essentially is a mechanism in which all of the genetic identity of the product comes from one source instead of a fusion of two sources. So it's essentially a carbon copy of one person. So how do you do that? So the way you do that is this. The nucleus of the egg is stripped. So it's called a denucleized egg. It's stripped. In place of the nucleus, you insert a complete cell, a somatic cell. Somatic just means a body cell. It could be a skin cell. It could be a tongue from under the tongue. It could be anything. There are 200 different types of cells, right? You can use a brain cell, although why would you go into the brain to do any type of cell? So therefore, in the where the nucleus of the egg was, instead of having a 50% genetic contribution, you have the entire genetic structure. Because every single somatic cell, and this is very amazing, contains the entire genetic code of the human organism. In your skin cell is dormant DNA for liver, brain, kidney. Except when it became a skin cell, that shut off. But it's still there. Okay, it's still there. It's an amazing idea. Every part of you, it's like a hologram. Every part of you contains the whole of you. But it switches off. Now, it was thought for many, many years, except in science fiction, that once a cell became specialized, the switching off was permanent. A skin cell could never get reactivated to produce something else. But through the magic egg, so to speak, this is exactly what happens in cloning. That the somatic skin cell, when it gets into the egg and it fuses with the egg, now becomes similar to a fertilized egg, which divides initially into stem cells and later differentiating into all the different cells of a human being. Okay, so number one, there's no sexual reproduction here. There is no union of sperm and egg. It all comes from one source. Number two, the what's called the expression of the somatic cell got reversed. And number three, what it basically means is that the genetic characteristics of the entity that will be born are 100% from one person. So again, be sure you understand that, meaning to say, this person that'll be born, assuming he'll get born, so far we haven't had a human clone, we had Dolly, we had a sheep clone, and we have had dogs and cats. So cloning has happened. We've had dogs and cats that are clones. Jurassic Park was based on the possibility of cloning dinosaurs, because sometimes DNA can survive for a very long time and the like. But the point basically is, so let me give you an example again. I think I gave you this example, but I'm going to build on it. Let's imagine you have a husband and a wife, and the husband is the last member of his family, all of whom died in the Holocaust. The husband was a victim of Nazi experimentation, and let's say the husband was castrated. Why the wife married him, without asking that, whatever, they got married before, they love each other, whatever it is. But he's been castrated. He's physically not able to produce sperm. How can they have a child? He's not able to produce sperm. He's castrated. So look at what happened here. Through an in vitro fertilization involving cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer, he and she can have the closest thing possible to an actual genetic child of both of them, although it won't be exactly that. Take the egg, strip out the nucleus, replace it with the DNA from his somatic cell, the skin cell. When that somatic cell fuses with the egg, that is the equivalent process of fertilization, so to speak. It is then transferred back into the woman's body. 9 months later, she will give birth to a child that is the genetic copy of her husband.
Except for mitochondria.
Except for mitochondria, that's 100% correct. Now, you might say, yeah, but that means she doesn't have a kid. Well, it's true that genetically she has not contributed, but on the other hand, mitochondria is a contribution. Hormonal influences. We spoke about the spiritual environment of the womb as being very important in the development of the soul. So, in the absence of an alternative, this is the closest thing that's possible to be able to create a child from both of them. I mean, what's the alternative? He doesn't produce sperm. They could adopt, of course. But let's say that they very much want to have a child together. So cloning is a mechanism that even without sperm, we can produce a child from a husband and a wife through the somatic cell DNA of the husband fusing with the denucleized egg of his wife. Right? Very, very amazing. There's actually another... Okay, I don't want to confuse things too much. I just want to keep cloning as simple as possible to understand that although we look at cloning as kind of a nightmare scenario and the like, people talk about cloning people to have spare hearts or whatever it would be. You know, I keep five of me in the closet, so in case I need a heart, you know, those are kind of the nightmare scenarios where you keep a lot of clones around for spare organs. But cloning can be a possible reproductive technology when there's nothing else. Now, keep in mind that at the same time, cloning can be utilized without the need of any relationship whatsoever. I gave you an example where cloning was a mechanism for a husband and a wife to have a child. But you know, cloning can be a mechanism to get rid of men entirely. I mean, I always knew, you know, men were largely useless. No, but because here's the thing. A woman can clone herself without a male factor whatsoever. Same thing. Take the egg, strip away the nucleus. She could put in, or you know, I mean, somebody will do it. She can put in her somatic cell into the egg. She carries her own baby, and she is herself. That's correct. She produces a baby that is a 100% genetic copy of her. You don't need a male factor here. In fact, when Congress of the United States was thinking of criminalizing cloning, they didn't want cloning, although they didn't do it. So one of the organizations that testified against criminalization of cloning were gay and lesbian groups, because they said that cloning is a way that we could have kids without these troublesome men hanging around. We don't need sperm banks, we don't need any of this, we can just do it ourselves. It's kind of the... Now, spiritually, I'm going to discuss the halacha, but spiritually you understand that this is very injurious, because Chazal gave us the very important teaching that there are three partners in the creation of a child: father, mother, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's true that I understand that even father and mother get attenuated when you have a sperm bank and the like, but at least there's a male and a female factor. Cloning is literally getting rid of any type of combination of factors. So that type of cloning is very, very problematical. Yeah.
What contribution to the child does mitochondrial DNA make?
Well, number one, it contributes to the survival of the child. The child will not live without mitochondrial. I'm not sure if it affects any characteristics of the child, but it's necessary for survival. So, in a sense, the life of the child is connected to the mitochondrial.
Unless there's a mitochondrial disease.
That
could be given onto the child.
That's only a negative contribution.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now, let me just raise some halachic questions about cloning. First of all, assuming that you're doing cloning for beneficial purposes, meaning you understand there are nefarious purposes here, right? The example is, I want a clone to have, you know, someone I could take a heart from if I need it. You know, that would be murder. But assuming, let's take the Holocaust example, that one is cloning for benign, constructive mitzvah purposes to have a child, would halacha prohibit producing human life through a cloning process? So let's first look at something in a very general sense. Some people, let's say right-wing Christians, for example, will say that it's wrong to clone because it is not the natural way of having children. Now, I think we discussed a number of times. That's correct. That halacha, since halacha does permit all sorts of unnatural ways of having children, including in vitro and egg donation and the like, so halacha does not forbid unnatural reproduction per se. That is not enough of a reason. That is not enough of a reason. And that goes back really to the beginning of Bereishis, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Adam B'tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. And although that is primarily referring to the godly soul, of course, but it does have a secondary aspect, that we interact with the environment in a godly way, meaning instead of saying nature is our limit, meaning nature is nature and we're stuck with it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us license to manipulate nature and work with nature. Just like, for example, we don't say, oh, if sickness comes from God, how can I go to a doctor? How can I take a polio vaccine? How can I try to cure illness? We say no. That is part of being in the image of God in that physical sense, is that we're not slaves to nature, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us rishus. Hashem gave us permission. Okay. But nevertheless, one possible issue of cloning, I'll tell you one possible issue, which may change in time if we ever do it, is that cloning may create great severe risks of great, great birth defects. You know, Dolly, the sheep that was cloned, it took around 250 attempts. And a lot of those attempts they weren't just stillbirths. I mean, they were actually defective, monster-like mutations.
Why does that happen?
Well, because it's not, you know, since, you know, this is the law of unintended consequences, meaning to say when you're manipulating fertilization techniques in the non-natural way, you know, things happen.
Like it wasn't put together properly?
Yeah. The fusion wasn't proper or the like. So there is always going to be the morality and the halachic impermissibility of engaging in technologies that create dangers and risks. You know, this was even a concern in the early years of in vitro fertilization. In the early years of in vitro fertilization, going back to the 1980s, for some reason, again, we don't always know the reason, there was a higher than normal incidence of birth defects. Now, as we get more proficient in the technology, right, that gets sharply reduced. And now there is no difference in birth defects between in vitro and not regular, you know, regular birth. But at least in the initial stages of a new technology, there are serious halakhic problems that you're not permitted to do things that create unreasonable dangers. Now, another example of a possible danger is, and again, for some reason the science is not clear on this, researchers are divided, there is an argument that a clone is born old. But what do I mean? Let's say that you take in other words, you fertilize the egg, it's not called fertilization, but whatever it is, you fuse the somatic cell to the denucleized egg. But you take the somatic cell from a 40-year-old person. The baby is born 40 years old. The phenomenon of premature aging.
Does your DNA...
Why? Because the DNA is older?
The DNA is older once there's cell differentiation. The germ cell doesn't age, per se.
Maybe you can take cells from a place where they multiply quicker, like the mouth?
Yeah. That's correct. So as a result, I'm not sure if they measure, I don't know why they couldn't tell it with Dolly, but some researchers claim that Dolly, I mean, sheep don't live that long anyway, but they claim that Dolly was born 15 years old, or whatever her mother was. Now, there actually is a medical condition, premature aging. Sometimes you see babies, is that what it's called? Yeah. Where someone, you know, looks 80 years old and they might be 5 years old or whatever it is.
Yep.
But the fear is that with cloning you'd actually be doing that because you're starting with DNA that has already been aged. Right? So that's one set of problems, meaning risks. Now there's another set of problems halakhically, and here I'm gonna have to be a little wild in some hypotheticals. That is, let's assume for a moment that I cloned myself. Okay, let's assume that, you know, again, somatic cell, etc. And 9 months later, my wife gives birth to an exact copy. Now, it's not going to look like me now. It'll be a baby. But the baby is genetically, essentially the baby is genetically my twin with a different mitochondria that was born X number of years late. So first of all, let's ask this philosophically. You know, one of the big problems that every parent and child faces is that parents often want to live their unfulfilled dreams through their children. So if dad was, you know, wanted to be a football player at University of Michigan, but had a bum knee, he's going to push his son, maybe even his daughter, to kind of go out for football. Well, if that's the pressure that you have when you just have a regular kid that's only 50% you, what's dad going to do when he sees that's what I looked like when I was 20? And yet, if we accept the premise that just because people have identical DNA, that does not mean their spiritual neshamas are the same. Right? A clone of Hitler is not necessarily going to be, you know, in science fiction, the boys, you know, this is an old science fiction conceit where somebody found a lock of hair of Hitler, whatever it is, and cloned, and they're like 100 Hitlers. You know. But the truth of the matter is, no, this was science fiction. This was a novel, and this was a movie, The Boys from Brazil. But Judaism believes in an X factor that is called Bechira, free will. Your biology is not the definition of what you are. Your DNA is not the totality of your personality. There's a godly soul, and the godly soul is given by God. It is not a function. It may be a function of the intention at the time of conception, but it is not necessarily limited to genetic contributions. And as a result, therefore, one has to know that a clone is a separate person, even though biologically or genetically it may be equivalent to an identical twin. The key Gemara here to recognize is this. There's a wonderful Gemara. The Gemara talks a lot about the idea that your personality is influenced by the mazel that you're born under, right? You know the word mazel? People know mazel tov means, you know, good luck, but really it means good constellations. You have may you be under a good sign. And there is a lot of discussion in the Gemara about astrology, the role of the stars and the planets in shaping our personality. Now the Rambam, who was a rationalist, rejected even those Gemaras, and the Rambam says, not true, not true, not true, astrology is a bunch of junk. The Rambam was willing to even reject statements in the Gemara. Other rabbis say, and I'm not here to decide this, that there is indeed a pseudo-astrology, which is junk, but Chazal were in possession of a real understanding of the powers of the stars and the planets, which has validity. In Kabbalah, there is much discussion of the influences of the stars and the like. Now, it is true, Ein Mazal LiYisrael, that as a Jewish person, we can transcend those influences by Torah and Masim Tovim and Tefillah. We are not bound by those influences, but they are what you might call the default setting, meaning they do have an influence on us until we break away. That's why Hashem took Avram above the stars, because it was in the stars that Avram could not have children, but Hashem said, you're above the stars. Now, the Gemara says the following. He who is born under the red planet, the red planet is, of course, Mars, will have the personality of a bloodlust. He will love the shedding of blood. Can't help it. He'll love blood. So you might say, oh gee, so he's stuck. No. He can choose to be a shochet, he'll slaughter animals for a mitzvah, or a mohel, one who does bris, or he can be a murderer. Now, that Gemara is making a very, very important point, because whether you go with the Rambam that there's no such thing as mazel, meaning constellations, the Gemara is addressing a much bigger point than astrology. Astrology is actually not the main point of that passage. The main point of that passage is, how do you reconcile free will with the part of our personality that is hardwired? Now, it's true, Chazal used mazel to describe the hardwiring. So let's say you want to be modern and you don't want to use that terminology. We could use DNA just as well. In other words, the fundamental question that's being addressed is, on one hand, we believe that every person has unlimited free will to be righteous or evil. On the other hand, we believe that everybody is born with a certain personality. Chazal described it as the constellation. We'll describe it as DNA. Now, you know, recently, in the past decade, scientists have mapped and sequenced the entire genetic structure of the human genome, right? I think we have basically 100% of it. And what we discover is that it's not just illnesses or physical characteristics like eye color that are based on DNA combinations, but there are emotional propensities, right? In other words, the gay gene has been identified, although, again, some of these are speculative, but people will identify the axe murderer gene, the disorganization gene, that's the one that I have, and the like.
Is that actually proven?
No, more and more there are indications that many, many aspects of our personality are genetically based. Now, this raises enormous philosophical problems. Because people are now saying, some people say, oh, if I have the anger gene, again, I'm oversimplifying, then you can't blame me just because, you know, you're so nice. That's because you have the good temper gene. Now, if you go with that, then the whole concept of Hashem requiring us to grow and to work on our midos and to improve and to struggle simply gets eliminated with this very crude biological determinism. So the Gemara is giving you an absolutely vital key. The Gemara is saying, you know, it is true that you're born a certain way. But your avoda is not to change your basic personality, but to take the structure Hashem gave you and direct it in good and productive ways. If you think about it, this is actually the central thesis of the Tanya itself. What is the idea of the Sefer Shel Beinonim? Okay, I'm not supposed to talk about Tanya so much about that. No, the Sefer Shel Beinonim is basically saying to be a tzaddik who simply destroys the bad, that you're not going to do. Or maybe Hashem will give you a gift, maybe not. That is not within your power to vanquish the bad. But what you do is you subjugate it so that the good, the godly soul within you, captures the garments of the soul, which is thought, deed, and speech. That's exactly what he's saying. It's not about, you know, you can't, you're kind of stuck. We're kind of stuck. But in our stuckedness, we have the capacity to take all of it and direct it in a good, holy way to bring godliness into the world. That's why it's called the Book of Beinonim. Literally, that means the Book of the Mediocre, but that's not, you know, it might get you depressed. In fact, the Baal HaTanya has, the Alter Rebbe has a chapter about how not to get depressed over that specter. But you see, this is a critical point. I'm bringing all of this in. It's connected to cloning in the sense that your biology may define a certain parameter, but what you choose to do with it, that's the godly soul kind of winning and being victorious. We call that bechira. We call that free will. That's what the godly soul does, right? Overpower. You're not going to be able to destroy. You're not going to be able to change it. It's always going to be in there. But you direct it in positive ways. That's really what Tanya is about. But as they say, this is really echoed in the Gemara and Masechet Shabbos, that the one who is born under the planet of Mars will love bloodshed, but you decide to do it in good ways. And this is very practical issues. You know, let's say, for example, so when you become parents, you know, be aware of this. Let's say you have a child that finds it difficult to sit still. Child's like very active, likes to move a lot. So sometimes, you know, there are these long Shabbos meals that go on for 5 hours, and the parents say, "You're going to sit in that chair and not move." That's not right. Because we have to teach you discipline.
It's wrong.
You have to learn to behave. Now, it's true that if somebody's always fidgety, somebody's always moving, you know, that's not always constructive. But you can take that energy and take that activism and give the child something good and creative and constructive. So what you're doing is, you're not trying to change the child, but you're directing the what is in the child towards something good. Okay, the one that's born under Mars, you cannot make him hate blood. He's going to love blood. But let him be a Moel instead of being a murderer. Right? That much you can do. Right? So that's the key. And to go back, if you ever learned the book of Mishlei, the book of Proverbs, that's why Shlomo HaMelech says, Chanoch Lenar. In fact, this is the pasuk in the second half of the second book of the Tanya. Chanoch Lenar al pi darko. What does that mean? Train, educate a child according to his way. Every person has his way, his derech. Don't do it based on your way or somebody else's way. His way.
How do you know what's the child's way?
That's the $64,000 question. You're right. You're right. You don't always know, but as a parent,
not everyone in the family is supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer, and yet
that's correct. That's 100% correct. 100% correct. That is why the clone of Albert Einstein might want to be a basketball player, and the clone of Michael Jordan might want to be a nuclear physicist.
What? Jewish DNA is doctor's
lawyer. Not really.
No, that's
so.
Jewish mother.
No.
That's what our mothers want.
As a matter of fact, this would take me far afield, but as a matter of fact, we could actually say that a very, very good case should be made that we should encourage our children to go into what are called the blue-collar professions. Plumbers, air conditioner.
We should.
Blue collar. They call it blue collar. Plumber, air conditioning repair people. First off, if you're going to live in Israel, You'll do a lot better doing air conditioning than teaching in a university. That actually is true. I know a person who was a professor of physics in Cambridge. So a smart guy, PhD in physics. He made Aliyah, and now he does air conditioning. He says, "You know, I'm doing a lot better than I did in Cambridge." Okay, but there are other reasons as well. Number one, it takes less schooling. The job is more secure. And you keep more of your mental energies for Torah and mitzvahs. In other words, you see, when a person is using his mental energies in his profession, then there's less energy for learning and for studying Torah. So the truth is that it's been so many years that parents look at blue-collar professions as an embarrassment and as something to be ashamed of, when in fact it could be the salvation. First of all, not all kids are academic. You know, a car mechanic is every bit as smart as a doctor. A car is a complicated thing, but it might be a different type of intelligence, and it's an intelligence that, you know, people don't admire as much. But you know, it's complicated. It's a complicated process, and it deserves respect. It deserves respect also. That's part of Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko. But the reason I just brought this up, this was an aside, but I think it was a useful aside. I brought it up as an aside because these are problems in raising children. If we ever do cloning, the problem is going to be magnified because you're going to be seeing yourself. And there'll be a tremendous push to try to make this kid live out my fantasies, when in fact this person has to have his own individuality. Okay, but now let me raise some technical halachic questions. That is, all right, I have my clone, and we've been living for 13 years, so my clone has now had his bar mitzvah. Okay? So there are eight, right? We walk into a shul for mincha. There are eight people in the shul, and I walk in with my clone. Do we count? Okay? We have to have a minion. Do we count as one, or do we count as two? Okay, so that's pretty simple. We count as two. Because after all, sometimes I give you a simple question. If I walk in with my identical twin that we were born the same time, right? No one ever said twins only count for one. So for sure, so a clone that's my twin that was born, you know, 50 years later, for sure we count as two. Okay, so that much I think we will accept. But here's the question. What is my relationship to my clone? Is my clone my son? Or is my clone my brother? Now, why would I say my clone is my brother? Because like this. I am born, my genetic makeup is the fusion of the sperm and the egg of my parents. The genetic makeup of my clone is the same. So in a sense, one could argue that a clone, halachically, and I'll give you some very practical cases, a clone halachically is not truly my son. A clone is my long-lost twin brother.
There's a song about this. It's not even halachically, genetically.
And as a result, my clone's grandparents, meaning my parents, are actually his parents. Now, this has some major, major repercussions. Let me give you a very simple example. I'll give you two examples. One is straightforward, one is a little bizarre, but you'll see the complication. Example number one. Let's assume I have natural children, egg, sperm, natural children, and I have a clone, because later I needed to do it through cloning. Now, when the person dies, when daddy dies, and daddy has a lot of property, let's say, so sons, right, in the laws of inheritance, children inherit before siblings, right? Your siblings inherit only if you have no children. If you have children, children get before siblings. So, does my clone inherit with my other natural children? If the clone is deemed my sibling because he comes from the fusion of the same egg and sperm as I came from, then indeed the natural children the other natural children will inherit all of the property and the clone gets nothing, because there is a brother or a sibling does not get property if there are children. If, on the other hand, we regard the clone as a child, then he would, right? So that's one difference. Now,
even creepier, do the kids call him dad?
Well, you could answer that with adoption. You know, that's adoption. You know, that's already, we have analogies of adoption, right? So we can call, you can always call people dad, etc. Now, let me give you another example. Are you familiar with the mitzvah of Yibum? Mm-hmm. The mitzvah of Yibum is called. I'll explain, because you need to know a little background knowledge here. Yibum is translated as levirate marriage, which, you know, probably makes no sense to you either. This basically means the following.
If a man dies
without children, there is a mitzvah on his brother. To marry the widow of his brother in order to perpetuate the seed and the memory of his brother who died without children. Now this is called Yibum. Say again?
The very small community is made.
Say again, I don't hear it.
The wife is also the mother of this kid or brother.
Well, yes. I'll get to the comment. I just want to be sure everyone knows the mitzvah. Now, the Torah does say, if either the man or the woman does not want, or the man's already married or something like that, so there's a ceremony called removal of the shoe, where called chalitza in Hebrew. So Yibum is the marriage, right? Where she removes his shoe, she pulls the shoe off his foot. There's a special boot, it's like a Viking boot that's laced up, and she spits in front of him. Not in his face, in front of him. The Torah says in his face, but we translate. In front of him. And she says, so shall be done to the man who does not want to rebuild his brother's home.
Even if she's the one that doesn't want.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Now, let me point out, there's an interesting...
Is there Kabbalah about this?
Yes, there is. There is, because it's a very deep... It's a very, very deep idea that the neshama of the person who dies without children cannot find rest or repose. Now, there's a big machlokas Ashkenazim and Sephardim you need to know about. Ashkenazim do not practice Yibum at all today. So if a woman is left childless from her husband, the only option is chalitza. She cannot marry anyone else if she gets chalitza. She has to get chalitza. We do not allow levirate marriage. Sfardim, in theory, still permit levirate marriage, although they agreed in Eretz Yisrael not to do it, to make.
Why is it would not be permitted?
Well, it's a complicated issue. Let me explain the issue. The issue is that normally marrying your brother's widow is incestuous, but the Torah permits it for the mitzvah. So the idea is that since people don't always have pure intention, it would be considered to be quasi-incestuous and the like. Now, this is Yibum and Chalitza. Now, if the woman has a child, not only is there no mitzvah of Yibum, it's forbidden, it is incestuous. So now, let's go back to this issue. This is now what you were referring to. Let's say that a man has no child from his wife except a clone. He cloned himself, and he has a clone. The clone could be, 20 years old. The man then dies.
She gave birth to the clone?
She gave birth to the clone, right? In other words, it was her egg. let's analyze this. If the clone
is the clone the brother or the child?
That's right. If the clone is the child, life is very simple. The man had a child. There's no Yibum. She can go ahead and marry anybody she wants. But if the clone, if the clone is the brother.
That's disgusting.
Does that actually mean that the child that came out of her body would be the person that has the mitzvah of Yibum?
What if she sees it as revolting? Then wouldn't she be exempt?
Well, she wouldn't be exempt, but she'd have to have chalitza. Yeah. No, you're correct.
If you can't force anyone, like if either
No, you're correct. No. Well, let me put it this way. You cannot force anybody to go through the yibum. 100% correct. But does she need chalitza? That's all. I mean, you know, you're right. I'm not raising any question of the woman being forced. That's not the issue. The woman can absolutely not. No, the woman can absolutely not be forced. Even in a regular case, she can't be forced. I'm just asking in terms of the outer limits of halachic bizarre permissibility, and I'm just raising the theoretical issue that perhaps the one that emerged from her womb. Would be the one that does Yibam, because technically that's not his mother. His mother is his grandmother. His mother is his father's mother. His mother is not his actual mother. And therefore, as a result,
not that the child calls the mother.
Well,
one is mother, the other is mom.
The other is mom. It's like your great-grandchild.
Yeah.
One of them is mommy.
So,
therefore, we don't allow plug.
Well, these are some of the complications. So these are issues. Again, these don't have a lot of answers because there's a lot of uncertainty. Now, as I say, as far as we know, no human being has been cloned yet. But, you know, there's probably some mad scientist somewhere that is trying to work on these issues. Of course, you know, they've done cows, they've done dogs. And of course, you know, there's recurring rumors of trying to clone. See, if you combine cloning and genetic engineering, then you know you want to create super soldiers. That's what Captain America. I mean, the whole scenario of genetically modify something and then you duplicate it. It's like a Xerox machine. You can then make a million copies, so to speak, of some genetically enhanced person, creating a super army. So once you start getting into, I mean, I'm not going to get into every science fiction scenario, but once you get into science fiction, actually it's not so science fiction, I mean, it's within the realm of possibility, but people are not necessarily... Now, let me just mention one other idea, though, and this is very important to know. Cloning does not have to be producing a whole human being. You can also clone, in theory, an organ. So the way that will work is, in other words, through stem cells. In other words, it's a combination of cloning and stem cell research. What you do is the following. You take the nucleus out of the egg, replace it with a somatic cell. It now becomes an embryo or a blastocyst that begins to divide. But for a few weeks, it'll just be stem cells for 2 weeks. You then take the stem cells, and you can coax them to become heart, liver, or the like. So you're using cloning not to create a human being. You're using cloning to create organ systems by harvesting the stem cells. Now, I want you to understand why that, in particular, is a truly magnificent accomplishment. Because, imagine this, we spent a lot of time talking about organ donation and all of the halachic problems of taking organs from brain dead people, that it might be murder. Okay, I think it's on the cloud thing. Now, putting aside halacha for a moment, the big secular problem with organ donation is there's a tremendous shortage of supply. There aren't enough organs. Halacha has many problems, and even societally, there's just not enough donors. But imagine this. Through cloning, you can create your own spare heart. Imagine this. So we'll get to that. In other words, let's imagine you can take a skin cell, put it into the egg. The egg divides, culture stem cells from the embryo, construct a heart. And you know, the big problem with all organ donation is that the body rejects foreign organs, but this is genetically your organ. So this is an amazing thing. You can make a heart out of a skin cell. Well, not yet, we can make heart tissue, but you can actually eventually make a heart out of a skin cell. This would absolutely solve the shortage of organs. It would eliminate the ethical problems of brain death, right? Cloning organs, tremendous thing. You understand how it works? In other words, you create the embryo, and then you harvest the stem cells, and the stem cells can be activated to turn into any type of the specialized tissue. The only problem is this. The only problem is that given the fact that a lot of disease is genetically based, if a person has a bad heart and you're creating a heart out of his own DNA, you might be giving him the same bad organ that needed to be replaced. But still, if it took like 50 years until the heart manifest itself in a bad way, then you know it might be, because that goes back to the old DNA issue.
Well, yes, but if the heart would be the age of the donor, of the person, yep, that
so you might have the same problem. Yeah,
exactly. So possibly by the time of reaching certain age,
yep,
that organ will develop the same illness.
That's correct. That's correct. So that is a potential problem. But even if we don't take it from the guy, we take it from somebody else, we at least don't have the shortage. We don't have the shortage number. You know, you have unlimited people that you can take it from, and then you'll have to deal with anti-rejection drugs and the like. So cloning organs is actually not a problem. Now, people don't want to do it because once you start cloning, you'll clone a human being and you'll get all of these problems. But theoretically, if you were to stop the issue at cloning organs, there would be no problem. And in fact, I would go even further. I had mentioned before that to deliberately create an embryo for stem cell research would be prohibited because of the emission of sperm in vain. Paradoxically, when you're cloning, that's actually not a problem because you're not producing the embryo by the emission of sperm. You're producing it by taking a somatic cell, right? So paradoxically, cloning organs would not even raise any halachic problem of emission of sperm.
You're placing it in an egg, right? In a strip.
That's
there
correct.
Any problem with egg donation?
Well, there is really not a problem with egg donation. That is not called the wasting of sperm. Mm-hmm. The only issue is, some say that since egg donation is done under general anesthesia, it's not proper for a woman to endanger herself unless it's for her therapeutic benefit. So that is a general concern. That are you allowed to put yourself in sakana for something that doesn't benefit you? So that might be an issue.
And if you're a married woman, aren't you that's a potential child, no?
That's correct. You're raising a good question, but all I can tell you is halacha is asymmetrical here, meaning mm-hmm. you're 100% correct. If the isser of emitting sperm is because of its potentiality, mm-hmm. then the same way you shouldn't emit sperm in vain, why can you give an egg in vain? It's a very, very good question, but all I can tell you is that halacha treats them differently, that there's something worse mm-hmm. with the emission of the sperm. Okay, so these are kind of, I think I covered what I wanted to cover. I hope you're not totally confused. But it just shows you that within the Torah, there are going to be ways of addressing every issue. We don't always have a final answer. It sometimes takes years until the rabbis have the data and they're able to analyze it correctly. But in Hashem's Torah, there will be the answer to every conceivable question that society will ever raise. Okay, so we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask you a quick question?